This is Dr. Debus.
Take number one.
Take number one. I wondered, before we get into, I would like to discuss the Apollo 8 mission itself.
Yeah.
In terms of KSC, but could we begin a little back farther, Dr. Debus? Could you tell me how the concept of the moon port evolved, the need for it, and what it now consists of as opposed to what we had before?
Yeah, well, it evolved with the need to have an operational basis. As you're probably aware, we have quite a number of launch pads here at the Cape Kennedy and Kennedy Space Center that are came into being based on military requirements. They served the need to develop certain types of ballistic missiles, rockets. And they were always there for a limited time purpose. In other words, when you had a number of development launches that could be anything between 10, 15, or 50, case of Redstone, for instance, then a missile system would be deployed and the facility largely abandoned. Now, we are here engaged in space operations, of course, and that would mean continuous use of a facility. Combined with this need to change from the what we call research and development pads to operational pads, came the recognition that we would have to be extremely flexible in order to accommodate astronomical windows given by the constellation of stars or planets rather than by other time schedules. Then the need to accommodate the specific weather conditions that prevail here, since this is hurricane country. So then we wanted to abolish the need to stand with our large launch vehicles here in the open for too long a time. And the fixed concept of pads, which is the research and development type, vehicles are built up on the pad if they are multi-stage vehicles. And they stay on the pad, they are checked out there until launch time. Large vehicles like Saturn V would require, in our then anticipated preparatory times, several months, something like 4, 5, 6 months of stay time at the Cape until stages and combined stages or vehicles were checked out together. We wanted to do that in some protective environment. We also wanted to make minimum use of the land that we were to acquire here. We wanted to set aside as much as possible for future, still larger vehicles. So all of this combined, and many other aspects, such as concentrating of key people, of who you usually don't have too many, not make them go to drive 20 miles between pads, but to have them together where it counted, led to the concept of concentrating preparatory work in a large enough building, concentrate work for there, make it hurricane-proof, and then roll out your configurations at the end of the in-house or in-shelter preparation and let it stay on the pad for the shortest possible time.
Sounds like a big order.
yes, and indeed, our launch concept out there does fulfill a big order. There are other niceties connected with it. If you look at the older configurations, including Saturn I, you see these large blockhouses. They are heavily sheltered with concrete enforced, and with about 8 to 10 or so feet of dirt on top of them in order to protect the launch crew, who is very close by in these old blockhouses. There would have been no possibility to protect people in the same fashion in a similar shelter in a Saturn V, which at that time was estimated to have an explosive power of some 1 million pounds of TNT in case it would blow up. So here the safety is given by distance, by separation between the launch control center, which is now open, has windows, is not protected against impact. And the actual launch pad, there is a protective, excuse me, difference, time, a distance of some 3 miles, which will permit to bring down any 7-5 that should go haywire.
Are the windows open during the Saturn V launches?
The windows are closed. It's all fully air-conditioned. These blinds you see are for sun protection, hurricane protection, rather than for explosive protection. Now, this technique then in turn required the use of computers, which we wanted anyway to apply, simply because we needed to save time in preparation. So these computers lend themselves specifically in two ways. One, they facilitate automatic checkout, and second, they permit traffic communication between two computers in a digitized fashion, which is safe against deterioration of the signal.
Yeah, in terms of your objectives that you set out when the Moonport concept was evolved, how in terms of facilities, how far have you gotten at this point?
Well, we have implemented the total industrial area, which has been complete for several years now. It's been used as our industrial base here. And we are essentially complete in Complex 39 with 3 bays fully equipped, 3 launch control centers fully equipped, 3 launch umbilical towers, and 2 pads. So we are in reasonably good shape for some traffic, which we hope will come about eventually.
Could you discuss for me generally the KSC or the Kennedy Space Center role in our manned program? At what point do you take over, and at what point do you relinquish control of a mission, for example?
Well, let me say that's not only in the manned program, that Kennedy Space Center is a main launch base, an operation base for all of NASA launches, because we also have a number of people, a launch crew out at the Western Test Range, which is in California. But we are an operations center as opposed to a research, scientific research center or a development center. We do indeed develop launch facilities, but it is a prerequisite rather than the intent of the development. We develop launch facilities because we are the people who have to operate them. Now, we obtain from all over the country either stages or spacecraft or parts of spacecraft. Those are first received here and checked out, partially operationally checked out, such as spacecraft do go in vacuum chambers where we take them to altitude, to considerable, almost high vacuum, where spacecraft as well as flight crews undergo their final checks in vacuum, in space environment. The stages are checked out in all those aspects that cannot be checked anymore once they are stacked, as we say, once they are put together to a launch vehicle. We check then the stages or the vehicles versus and with and in connection with the ground equipment in a gradually progressing fashion, so that at the end of these preparations we are assured that we haven't overlooked any shortcomings or failures. So in a way, we are the last stages of preparation before actual launch. Now that involves also a considerable assessment of the quality processes that have gone in this equipment. It is for the agency and for the program directors a last checkpoint of all preceding work, not only whether it functions all right, but whether its quality is as it was supposed to be. So we are an agency safeguard against faulty hardware getting into the launch. Now, This can, of course, only be to a certain extent. We cannot open every gadget or every black box here anymore, and shouldn't really. But in the processes that have evolved as the checkout processes, we largely find those conditions that are unsatisfactory, let the development centers take care of the remedial measures required. And that's a very important point. We operate here under the concept that the development centers remain fully responsible for their product. We do not change anything that they do not wish us to change in a way that they prescribe.
I see. That's very interesting. That's a good point.
Yeah.
You don't just get a rocket from someplace and throw it up on the pad. There's an awful lot of work to do.
No, there's a lot that goes between the development centers and us.
Has the upcoming Apollo 8 mission, I guess, will mark the third launch of the Saturn V. How have things changed since the early days of rocketry when, I don't know what the number is, how many unmanned launches preceded, for example, the first launch of the Redstone with Alan Shepard?
There were some 30, 40, or 50 Redstone launches before Shepard flew. How has it changed? The general pattern is that in the early days, guided missiles and rockets were flown in order to find out what was wrong with them. And in doing so, we gradually found out what is now referred to as the environment. That means all the vibrations, temperatures, pressures, aerodynamic forces. Many of these things that are now known were not known at this time and had to be tested or experienced by a lot of firings. Today's technique is to develop on the ground with a qualification test program all structures and systems exposed on the ground in laboratories to the same type of environment we now know exists. And therefore, when we go to a launch act, we are quite certain that the equipment will stand this environment, this strange environment of flight, of rocket flight and space. So the big change is that we have no need for great numbers of launches anymore to assure ourselves that these vehicles work, but the requirements are engineered into the systems and they are tested on the ground to exceed even the requirements that they will have in flight.
That's a good point. Can you discuss for me the upcoming mission of Apollo 8, and also in terms of the mission objectives, as well as the KSC role and the significance of the mission?
Yeah, well, we are about less than a month before launch, of course. The launch is now scheduled for 21st December. We'll have about 5 days to bring about that launch. In the middle of the preparations, of course, testing has progressed very satisfactorily. We are, at this moment, filling the hypergols into the spacecraft, which is a several-day activity. We are past some very essential tests, like the flight readiness tests, which uses the the empty vehicle to go through all phases, including launch, which of course does not take place but is simulated, and then we fly all the stages and the spacecraft later with the astronauts in shirt sleeves flying their mission. So we see to it that every stage does its job and whether all the internal systems function as they're supposed to. So that is then the total flight, including preparations to launch, but without fueling. Another type test, which is still ahead of us, it's called countdown simulation test. There we really fill the vehicle. We go through all paces and bring the vehicle to launch without launching it. That will give us an opportunity to measure the time required and exercise and train people in doing each individual function moving a ladder or moving some type of a bracket inside the vehicle. These large vehicles are all worked in inside. They are not serviced from the outside. And that gives us a good assurance of that we have no leaks in the cryogenic lines. This is liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, that our pressures are at the right level, very accurately specified, and so on. It's a whole myriad of things that are being tested in these tests. That test will be about 3 or 4 days long. At its completion, then, we are ready to go into the actual countdown. Which would then be culminated by a liftoff somewhere between 7 and 8 in the morning on 21st December, which I'm hopeful we can meet. Now, the mission here is to first go into Earth's orbit with an Apollo spacecraft and a just weight simulator for the lunar module. Once we are in Earth's orbit with the third stage, we should have approximately half of the third stage fuel left over. There will be a checkout, which will be done by the Mission Control Center in Houston, of the spacecraft as well as the third stage. If everything should be found okay, then at the right moment we will reignite the third stage on a escape trajectory to the moon. Once the proper speed is reached, then there will be a separation from the third stage. The third stage will be kicked off so that it will not impact on the moon. We are presently looking at all aspects whether this indeed can be accomplished. The spacecraft itself will then be, of course, going through maneuvers of mid-course correction, and if everything is all right, they will not return. Should anything happen on the way to the moon, crew can turn the spacecraft around and propel it back to the Earth. We will then go near the moon and have again an option here. If everything is all right, we will break this velocity using the service propulsion engine and catch the spacecraft in an orbit around the moon. If any one of a given number of systems should not work properly, and we are already on the second system, then we will just fly by the moon and return to Earth. Once in lunar orbit, we will stay there for some 8 hours or so, for 8 revolutions at about 60 miles altitude, and there is a total mission activity going on while in lunar orbit, taking pictures and measurements and communication tests and a great number of activities that need to be carried out, and that give us then a very good indication whether our planning for the landing is all right. After these lunar orbits, then the spacecraft, the propulsion module will be ignited again and propel the spacecraft toward a trajectory to the Earth. Again, after mid-course maneuvers, we will then, shortly before re-entering, discard the service module, which is a general propulsion module, and the spacecraft proper, the Apollo spacecraft, will then re-enter the Earth's atmosphere with a planned landing area in the Pacific.
Very good. Nice brief description of it. Fine. One more question.
All right.
If you were to summarize in 25 words or less the year for the Kennedy Space Center, what would it be, of course, excluding, of course, the Apollo 8 mission, what would be the most...
You mean the past year or the coming year?
In 1968.
You know, in the past year?
Mm-hmm.
Our biggest milestone was doubtlessly the manned flight of Apollo 7. It was a culmination of many years of preparation.
Very good.